Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 144 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's Awards podcast, presented by the iconic Empire Hotel on New York's Upper West Side. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a handsome and charismatic television executive turned on-air host, Andy Cohen. The 48-year-old is, for better or worse, largely responsible for creating the reality television era in which we now live, as the primary force behind Bravo's Real Housewives franchise. He also created and hosts a unique and popular late-night talk show, Watch What Happens Live, which also airs on Bravo. Cohen has been a part of the New York television scene since 1990, when he began a meteoric rise to prominence, initially behind the scenes at CBS, then at Barry Diller's startup cable network Trio, and starting in 2005 at Bravo, where he helped to develop and/or oversaw shows like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, Project Runway, for which he won a Peabody Award in 2007, Top Chef, for which he won an Emmy Award in 2010, and, starting in 2006, a phalanx of shows about wealthy and often outrageous housewives, which, for millions of Americans, have become must-see TV, the modern successor to the soap opera. Cohen's colorful in-house commentary about the housewives led to a series of events through which he ultimately realized his real dream of being on TV himself as the host of his own talk show, which quickly gained a following and expanded from one night a week to two, to its current five, and which made him the first ever openly gay host of an American late-night talk show. Over the course of our conversation at the Empire Hotel, Cohen and I discussed a wide range of topics. Among them, what it was like growing up as an ambitious but closeted gay boy in St. Louis at a time when he felt he couldn't acknowledge his sexuality to friends or family. How he made his way to New York and worked his way up the social and professional food chains. Why he initially resisted going to Bravo, resented some of the talent that he had to deal with when he arrived there, and ultimately championed the housewives concept. How he responds to the not insignificant number of people who scathingly accuse him of dumbing down America, setting back feminism, and playing an instrumental role in creating a climate in which Donald Trump could become president of the United States. And why he came to love his work on Watch What Happens Live so much that he ultimately gave up his executive responsibilities to focus full-time on creating a late-night talk show unlike any other. Oh, and we also play a round of Cohen's trademark Plead the Fifth game and cover all sorts of other fun stuff. He's a great sport, and I hope you'll enjoy the conversation as much as I did. So, without further ado, let's go to it. Andy, thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Normally, I get right into the questions, but I have to just share a quick little funny thing, which is that it turns out, unbeknownst to both of us, we were both at a very cool thing, a small thing, at the same time in November 2009. I come into New York with a female friend of mine. I go to this little premiere of a documentary about Valentino.
Yep.
And then afterwards, we hear there's the after party at the Boom Boom Room, which I think was one of your places, and show up there, and it's kind of quiet and slow and whatever, and we're having fun, but just drinking, gets late. All of a sudden, all hell breaks loose around us, and the event was being DJ'd by Madonna's boyfriend.
Yes.
Very young guy at the time, and we look around, and Madonna has shown up and is hitting the dance floor, I guess, to try to get the thing going. So everybody around us, we're not dancers, my friend and I, but we're looking around. Everybody else is seizing the moment and going dancing with Madonna. So we said, what the hell?
Right.
And it's going to be a great story. Nobody's ever going to believe this because her people were knocking phones out of the way and whatever. So fine. Nobody did really believe it for years and years and years. Then I get a tweet a few years later. Somebody found a photo and said, "Is that you with Madonna on this dance floor?" And I said, I couldn't believe it. I opened it up. I put it up on my social media. And the funniest thing was that everybody said, "Forget about Madonna. That's Andy Cohen to your right."
So funny.
So I don't know.
Oh yeah, there I am. And that's my best friend Bruce with his hand around her.
Yes, he was not being
shy. Yeah, we were just glomming onto her as much as we could.
Well, she's one of your ultimates, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
she hasn't done my show.
Well, not yet.
She's on the list.
Not yet. But that was hilarious. That was really my introduction to you, because at that point it was 2009.
That was the year my talk show
You were
premiered.
Just going on. Yeah. And I must say that prior to that, I was not really I was not a housewives person, but it was it started me on,
that's funny.
On this. So anyway, where we normally begin is just the basic. Where were you born and raised? What did your folks do for a living?
Born and raised in St. Louis, parents were in the food manufacturing and distribution business. My family owned this company since 1901. My great grandfather started it, and I spent every summer working in the family business. I did everything from work on the assembly line to make deliveries. I drove a forklift, believe it or not. Yeah, I was there every summer. I knew I wanted to work in TV. My family had no connection to TV. It was something totally foreign. And I just said, okay, I'm just going to break away. I knew that I could run the family business potentially if, you know, I wanted to stay in St. Louis and do that, but I didn't.
So just to reiterate, you're growing up in the middle of the country.
Yep.
Sounds like middle class.
Yep.
And what was your actual personal exposure and level of interest in pop culture generally?
Oh, it was high. I mean, I was the guy in high school who subscribed to Interview magazine, and I was like poring over it. And I loved TV. I mean, there were three TV channels. I was glued to the TV. I wanted to be a part of it. Then cable came along. When I was in kind of early high school or maybe eighth grade, something like that. And I was blown away by MTV and CNN. And I just, you know, and my original goal was I wanted to be myself on TV in some iteration.
Which in those days was not a common thing
at
all.
It wasn't. I mean, you know, maybe on morning television. Right. I don't know what that would have been. I said to myself, I'm going to go to college. I'm going to study broadcast journalism. I had a great regard for broadcast journalism. It was a time when TV news kind of meant something.
Right.
And I wound up working at CBS News in New York behind the scenes for 10 years.
But before we even go there, okay, let me ask you this. The mechanics of TV interested you at a very young age. I was reading about the fact that this book, the I Love Lucy book, played a big part in your life. Why was that?
I used to check it out from the library as much as I could. And it was behind the scenes. It was the behind the scenes story of the making of that show and how it came together and whatever. And I was fascinated. I was like, here's my favorite, one of my favorite shows. And wow, Lucy made Vivian Vance, you know, be fatter than her. And she was fighting with Desi, and Desi revolutionized the way sitcoms were shot. And I just couldn't believe there was this big story behind the show. And I was like, wow, this is a business people get paid for, and I could be a part of this.
Okay, so another thing just to set the scene before you go off to New York and really start on this path. What was it like, if it's not too personal to ask, growing up in the middle of the country at that time, knowing that you were a gay man?
It was not great. I didn't have any gay role models. Gay people on TV at the time consisted of like Paul Lynde and Charles Nelson Reilly,
right,
who were really punchlines. I mean, they were delivering punchlines, but, you know, it was not, they were not aspirational, right, to me. And so that was not necessarily who I thought I wanted to become at some point.
How early on did you know that was what you
I
were?
I knew I was gay from, you know, the time my dad was taking me to the tennis club when I was seven, mm-hmm, and I was spending too much time in the locker room. And so, yeah, no, that was in an idyllic childhood, that was definitely the that was the hiccup, and it was a big hiccup, and it was something that kept me up at night. And I, you know, my parents were very accepting, liberal family, but I did not think they would accept me. They didn't have any gay people in their lives.
So they didn't find out until after high school and everything, right?
Found out in college, about a few months after I came out in college.
But what's interesting also is that while you were still presumably living at home, still attending high school, you've said that it wasn't a matter of, you know, your peers necessarily either knowing or caring, because let's just note, if I have my notes correct, voted most talkative, biggest gossip, but also class president.
You
were a, you know, popular
kid.
Yeah.
I was really popular. And, you know, I think in some level people must have, you know, they didn't know. It was just a different time.
Yeah.
I graduated high school in 1986. It was just, think about it, the real world started, I think, in 90 or 91. And that was the first kind of gay guy my age that was on TV. So there was just not a representation of being gay around. There just wasn't. It was gay people were dying of AIDS. Right. That was it. And they were punchlines. So
any turmoil, though, that it caused was internal is what you're basically saying.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. It was not something I discussed with anyone.
Right.
Yeah.
So now, just sticking on high school for a moment, who were, I guess, Jean and Jackie? This is also
Jeannie and Jackie.
Jeannie and Jackie.
Were two girlfriends of mine in high school who, hilariously enough, I mean, here we are, it's 2017. I spoke to both of them this morning.
Really?
Jackie's renovating my house in Sag Harbor.
Okay.
Jeannie, I posted a picture of on Instagram yesterday. We made plans for Memorial Day weekend. They're still very much a part of my life. But I call them the original Real Housewives because I was stirring the shit up with them.
Right. They had a little feud or something.
They were like frenemies. They were best friends, but frenemies. And they were like my Alexis and Crystal.
Right.
And, my Vicky and Tamara, however, whatever analogy or metaphor you want to say.
Right.
And, I was the guy that was like, oh, well, Jackie said that you, it was terrible. And now I'm doing it.
That you owe them royalties
national
now.
Scale.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Right. So even while you were in high school, you were laying the groundwork for the career that would follow, right? Because you were, I guess, in St. Louis finding some internships and things.
Yeah, I was an intern at the local CBS affiliate and at KMOX Radio, which was the voice of St. Louis. I didn't want to work in radio, but I just would take any job in media that I could.
And so you go off to college at Boston University. I've seen different reports. What were you pursuing as a major?
I was pursuing broadcast journalism.
Okay.
Yeah.
And with what future in mind at that
point?
I wanted
to be a reporter on a local station anywhere. With hopes of moving up the ladder to the biggest place I could get.
Sure. And even while you're at BU, though, that's when you first started going into New York to...
No, I really came to New York. I interviewed Susan Lucci. She was my first big interview. I had an assignment to write a feature story in a news writing and reporting class mm-hmm. about someone. And they said, reach for the stars, try to interview someone famous and get it published in the free press.
Yeah.
And I did. And I got an interview with Susan Lucci. But then I wound up interning at CBS News in New York. My summer before my senior year, I was accepted for internships at KSDK in St. Louis, which is very powerful NBC affiliate in mm-hmm. St. Louis, and at CBS News in New York. And I remember telling the woman at Channel 5 that I was going to instead accept the internship at CBS in New York. And she said, you're making the biggest mistake of your career. And I said, what career? Yep. I don't have a career. And of course it wound up being the greatest thing I ever did because it changed my course. Cause I said, oh, okay. I'm no longer going to move from market to market. I just want to move straight to New York and I want to swim with the big fish
sure.
and I'll be a small fish. And I was like, I'm going to move to New York. I'm going to start waiting tables until I get a job at CBS.
Right.
Cause I wanted to work at CBS. And I didn't even have to start
Why
waiting tables.
CBS?
It was because it was where I knew people.
Yeah.
Right. I was an intern at the morning show, which was horrible. It was number three. It was a laughing stock. But everybody was coming on the show. I mean, here I was in the green room with Henry Kissinger and Joan Rivers and all these people. And I was like, well, this is where it's at.
Right.
It's happening.
Right.
So I wanted to be there.
So it's, I guess, 1990. You just graduate. You're in your early 20s.
Yeah.
You moved to the big city here. What was your life outside of, I guess, so you immediately started working there, but what was your personal life like?
My personal life was great.
Yeah.
And a million friends. I mean, my Jeannie and Jackie moved to New York at the same time
okay.
I did.
Yeah.
So there they were. I had friends from college who moved to New York. And all my friends from then are still my great friends.
Yeah.
People talk about, oh, you have so many famous friends. And I do. And I've had these, I've known Sarah Jessica Parker since 2000 or 1999.
Right.
But my real core group of friends has not changed.
So the CBS period there was obviously went well. You're worked your way up, I guess, to senior producer of the early show in 48 Hours, which,
yep.
And how quick a turnaround was that?
I was... At the time, my rise at CBS was considered fairly meteoric because I was the youngest. I was the youngest associate producer. Then I was the youngest producer. And I think I was the youngest senior producer, too, because that all happened when I was in my 20s,
wow.
I think. So, yeah, at the time, it was considered meteoric, yeah. I guess. And I was always the youngest. I forgot that.
So why then in 2000, I believe, did you decide to leave?
I had spent 10 years at CBS News for the entire 90s. And it was, I was back at the morning show. I was really comfortable. You would argue too comfortable. Yeah. I had exactly my life. I knew what I could get away with. I knew when I didn't have to show up. I would like go to LA, spend 10 days there around the Oscars. I would do, you know, it was like, and I had become friendly through my friend Bruce with Barry Diller at the time. Okay. And he said, you have to leave there. You have to leave there. And I was like, why? You know, everything's perfect. I'm really comfortable. He said, well, that's why. Like, you know, why I left is he offered me a job to run programming at a cable startup called Trio that he was starting, which was meant to be an arts and culture channel in the vein of kind of what you want PBS to be, right. Kind of more in the vein of Channel 4 in the UK, creating kind of smart, buzzworthy documentaries right. And original programming. And I knew how to produce television, but I didn't know much more than that. I knew about booking. I knew, you know, so, but I didn't know about budgets. I didn't know about ad sales, marketing, right. Anything. So and it was a startup. So it was about a year or two after I was there that the channel wound up even getting on air.
Right.
So I learned from the ground up about starting a cable channel and what that meant. And from Barry Diller and Stephen Chow. So I have Barry to thank really for my career in cable.
And is that also where you first crossed paths with somebody that you continue to work with, I think, Lauren Zelaznik?
Lauren Zelaznik. Yes. Lauren wound up taking over for Trio a few years into my run there. Trio, we were Barry's company merged with Universal. Then Universal and NBC merged. NBC Universal pulled the plug on Trio, moved Lauren Zelaznik to Bravo. Lauren said, I want you to come run programming at Bravo. And I said to myself, I don't want this job. I don't identify with the Bravo brand, which was hilarious.
Yeah, what was it at that time?
Well, it was really gay, which is so funny. It was gay weddings. It was Queer Eye, Boy Meets Boy. I wanted to go run programming at Logo, which was just starting. And I interviewed with Brian Graydon, and I did not get the job. And I kind of, to this day, can't get over that I didn't get the job, because there's no one gayer. You know, I mean, I just
But
can't
also
get over
ask yourself this. Why did you not want to go to Bravo?
I have no idea. I have no idea. But it's another life lesson where it's like the job you think you want to get, like, you know, maybe isn't the job that you were meant to get, because I would say that it was destiny that I went to Bravo. I became Bravo Andy. Lauren wound up through a series of events putting me on the air, and my goal of being on the air was fulfilled years after the fact.
Right.
Oh, you know, 16, 17 years later.
Well, let's break that. Okay. Let's break down how that happened. Because first of all, so your job title initially there was programming executive,
my original job title at Bravo was in charge of production.
Okay.
So my team made the shows, and there was another team that developed the shows.
And what were the shows?
I get credited with creating The Real Housewives.
Yeah.
In fact, okay. Amy Intercasso Davis
yes.
developed The Real Housewives of Orange County, brought it over to me and Sherry Levine and Frances Barrick. We then produced it. And, you know, kind of turned it into what it is.
Right, right, right. But you're also working with a lot of other shows at that time,
Well,
right?
The shows, so Project Runway had wrapped the first part of its first season. We hadn't shot the finale. So now we're in post on Project Runway. Took over production of Queer Eye, which was a real bear. Because all those guys now were super famous, and half of them were acting like assholes. Right. I mean, it was talent management, and it was a lot. Right. That was a huge bear. Right, that took up a lot of hours of my day.
Because they were still delivering big ratings?
It was a huge show. It was a big franchise show for the channel.
So you had to deal with
it. And it was a great show.
Yeah.
But it was a nightmare. And they were but they were also being nominated for Emmys every year.
Right.
We developed, you know, so then Lauren Zelaznik says, I want to do for food what we did with fashion. So we work with the Magical Elves and we create Top Chef.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a show that I think, I don't even think development even had any, I think that went straight to production because we knew we were, it was an automatic green light. That was a show that gave me so many sleepless nights because we did not have a host for season one until I want to say 2 or 3 days before we started. Because we hired Padma and then she bailed on us to go shoot a mini series in India. We had no host. We were going out to everybody. And I remember meeting someone brought me Katie Lee Joel. And I was like, you know what? She's a foodie. And we told her to be real. We produced her horribly because we told her to be really stern.
Right.
And because we didn't think anyone would take her seriously because she had a Southern accent and she was like 24. And, you know, now Katie Lee is this big, you know, food person.
Right.
And but at the time, she didn't have credibility and whatever. But so that's how Top Chef.
Right.
You know, that was the beginnings of that. Gosh, Millionaire Matchmaker, yep. Rachel Zoe, Flipping Out, Million Dollar Listing.
And you came to enjoy all this stuff?
I loved it. No, it was amazing. Yeah. No, it was amazing. And I became Bravo Andy. So in the course of this, and in the course of The Real Housewives, and in the course of really the success of Project Runway, Lauren Zelaznik said, I started emailing them dishy stuff from the set of a show, and she said, you should write a blog on the Bravo website. You'll be the only television executive that's writing a blog. I start writing a blog. Then I start getting interviewed on CNN and various things because there's a TV executive who can talk about TV.
Right.
Then she says, I want you to do a show on BravoTV.com that's like an after show after Top Chef after and Top Project Chef. Runway.
Right.
I do that. Then we need someone to host a reunion show because Housewives season two, Orange County is hitting.
Right.
I do a reunion show. Now this, I'm like, this is my big, this is amazing. Because
you're now getting to do what
I'm
you
getting
really
to
wanted
be on
to
the
do.
Air.
Right.
But I didn't want Lauren or any or Francis to think that I thought that I was valuable as an on-air person. So I was like, just pay me a dollar. Pay me as little as you can pay me. They're like, we have to pay you for this stuff. I remember saying, like, pay me $100.
Right.
Like, I don't want, because I knew they could get someone else to do it who was a name. And so anyway, and I started doing, I became kind of reunion show guy.
Sure.
And then Michael Davies, now I'm running production and development.
Right.
So now, now I'm EVP of all production and development. I've got like 30 shows.
Right.
I've got massive development slate. I mean, this is serious development.
Yeah.
We're developing Scripted. We were developing Girlfriend's
Right.
Guide. We were developing Odd Mom Out. And then Bravo, Michael Davies, who is my patron saint in television besides
Right.
Lauren and Francis,
Right.
comes to Bravo and says, I have this little studio. He took me out for lunch after he saw me hosting a Flipping Out reunion.
Right.
And he said, you are talent. You are on-air talent.
Right.
And I was like, I was so excited that someone outside the network was looking at me like
Right.
I there was something in me that could work on TV
Right.
that I was just really flattered. And he said to Bravo, I can do Andy's show that he's doing online from my little studio. And I remember in 2009, a good friend of mine died suddenly. And a week later, I took a week off from work. A week later, I came back and Bravo said, do you want to do your show on air? And I thought, wow, isn't this ironic? This is my big break.
Right.
And, but because my friend died, it's like, it was actually, it put everything in perspective.
Right, right.
Because I was like, it just really was a good check for me because, and it was just good perspective.
Sure.
And so I do the show. I'm sweating profusely. We don't have air conditioning in the clubhouse,
Right.
but we're live at midnight on a Thursday
Right.
night. And, you know, it wasn't, it makes me cringe when I watch it now. We try to do a lot and my face is tense, but I remember I wasn't nervous. I remember like right before air, I went to the bathroom and I was in there and I looked at myself in the mirror and I was like, you got this. This is, you know, this is your thing. And so at the time, the biggest thing that upset me at the time was when people said I gave myself my own talk show.
Because there was this assumption, all right,
yes.
there's an exec with his own show.
Exactly. He must have given it.
Right.
And, you know, the truth is you can't give yourself your own talk show. I couldn't have said to Lauren and Francis, I want to be the face of the network.
Right, right.
And that didn't happen until years later
sure.
that people started calling me, oh, he's the face of Bravo. And, you know, one needs to understand that if one is head of programming for a channel and one goes to their your boss, because everybody has a boss,
right.
and says, I want to be the face of the channel, or I want to host a late night show, the answer is 99% of the time going to be, go do your job and make hit shows.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
We had a lot of hit shows, and I was kicking ass as a production executive and development executive. I had a great team. I knew how to delegate. I knew, you know, I was always there. I always answered my emails. I always responded.
You weren't taking your eye off the ball for
anything. I never took my eye off the ball. I'm on my show at midnight. I am at a programming meeting at 9 a.m. the next morning.
Right.
So, and what happened is the ratings were good. And that's the other thing. If the ratings had been bad,
you're gone.
No one looks at the ratings before I do in the morning. And I know these ratings are good, these are bad. If the ratings were bad, I would have gotten canceled.
So before we go any further down the road with your own show, let's go back to The Housewives. Because even before people knew you as the guy who's doing Watch What Happens Live, you were the Housewives guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important maybe for folks who need to be brought up to speed. Let's just contextualize this. The original Real Housewives was Real Housewives of Orange County, goes on the air in 2006. You're one of the EPs, as we said. What was the context in which that showed up in the scene? Were, you know, what came before
Desperate
it?
Housewives.
That was the big
the context.
Thing?
Desperate Housewives was the biggest hit on TV.
Okay.
And so here we are developing a show about neighbors in Orange County in a gated community whose hair is blonder, their boobs are bigger, they're all rich, they're like varying degrees of hotness. And it became to me, look, they all went to the same tennis club. I was like, this is like Peyton Place or Knott's Landing.
Right.
Literally, they live in a cul-de-sac.
Right.
So we called it the Real Housewives, not the Desperate Housewives, but there are Desperate Housewives, but they're the Real Housewives. And still to this day, people call the show the Desperate Housewives.
Right.
That was the context.
And also,
Lauren Zelaznik had the brilliant idea right before we premiered of saying, we're going to call it the Real Housewives of Orange County. And I was like, that's so dumb. She said, we're doing it in case we ever do it anywhere else. I go, we're never doing it anywhere else. We almost canceled the first season because it was tough to produce. It was
also, how do you explain what this is? It seems like,
we kind of said it's a real life Desperate Housewives.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also though, just to mention, I don't know if any of these things actually were on your guys' radar. You're thinking about it at the time, but just culturally, this was only a few years after the OC, the narrative.
Well, that was the other thing. There was the OC in Laguna Beach, so it almost seemed tired.
Right.
It almost seemed like we were getting into the OC at the wrong time. It had been played out.
Plus, reality's blowing up everywhere. You have right around that time, think Simple Life, as you say, Laguna Beach, The Hills, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, maybe right after. There was no, it wasn't like the safe bet at that point. Obviously.
Well, we were doing reality, but
it was not
necessarily a bet at all.
Some people have asked, first of all, you know, how do you even find these women? Forget the first season, but like generally now it's everywhere.
What was great is that in the first groups, Amy's team had been developing a show called Manhattan Moms.
Okay.
They were developing around a group of women in Atlanta that was going to be about a show called Hotlanta, about how Atlanta was the Black Hollywood. And so we had these shows in development, but I think Amy went out and found the Jersey Housewives with Sirens and said, okay, let's find a group of women who all know each other.
Right.
So basically how the original casting people found women, you know, and in New York, they were going to country clubs. They went to Bridgehampton Polo, which is where a lot of douchey people hang out who might want to be on TV.
Right.
So, you know, and we looked for groups of real friends.
So that's what you're looking for in them. What do you think these women, especially having
fame.
Seen...
One thing money cannot buy is fame.
Okay, but
period.
Knowing that the fame is going to come at the price of exposing themselves, not always in a very flattering light.
You know what?
They don't
One
care.
One thing money cannot buy is fame. Fame is an aphrodisiac.
And to your point, not only fame, but there's the potential for some of them have done
well, listen,
very well.
This is before branding was really a thing. So if you look at Bethany, you've got to give her credit in season one of The Housewives for sitting there with Luann saying, oh, I made up my own cocktail. It's called the Skinny Girl Margarita.
She was
and this is
it.
What it is.
Right.
And she had a company called Bethany Bakes. And that's why she went on The Housewives. She wanted to promote her brand of freaking muffins.
And that wasn't something where you guys are saying this is not your vehicle to, so, you know, sort of surreptitiously get promote your stuff.
We liked it because that was her real job. We wanted women who had real things going.
Okay.
We resented the women who were just finding stuff. Or New York, we always had the hardest time with because people were coming up with stuff. Jill Zarin was like shilling this and that and the other. And we were like, this is gross. You have to stop.
Well, so sticking on Bethany Frankel for a second, just to, you know, for anybody who maybe isn't a follower of this stuff, debuted on Real Housewives of New York 2008. 2010, she gets her own spinoff show on Bravo, Bethany Getting Married. And by early 2011... Cover
of
Forbes sold the Skinny Girl cocktail line for, it's been reported, anywhere from $8 to $120 million. But regardless, that's a hell of a...
Cover of Forbes. She was living in a really shitty one-bedroom apartment when she started shooting on Housewives.
So when you see that, what goes through your mind?
Makes me super proud of her, super excited
but
for the show.
But I mean, just the potential, what I mean from the point of the view of the show is like, you've got something that can do that.
Yeah. But it... You know what? It has to be right, and the idea has to be good. It's so much more than the show because there are 10,000 products that the women have tried to launch that have gone completely. There's a warehouse full of Fabellini somewhere that Teresa Giudice is paying rent on.
But she did become a best-selling author. You've got other people doing people, you know, using some of them for very good things, causes, and whatever, using the platform. But why do you think, in terms of your audience for those shows, why do you think people generally, but especially women, watch these shows in such large numbers? What's the allure?
Because it's the modern soap opera, and we love to judge human behavior. And the themes are, the casting is great, and the themes are universal. Being a wife, being a mother, being a friend. And it's real, and there are real stakes between these friends, and it's relatable.
So how real is it? Because that always comes up. Is there any degree of...
There's no storyboarding. Yeah. There's no... We have to plan where they're eating. They're encouraged to think on camera.
Yeah.
They're encouraged to talk about what's been going on with them.
And while the Housewives franchise was becoming this phenomenon, you were simultaneously still involved with these other things.
Yeah.
Winning in 2007 a Peabody for as an EP of Project Runway, 2010 an Emmy as EP of Top Chef. And yet, I wonder how you handled, because, you know, these are, some would argue, there's the highbrow, there's the lowbrow side of Andy, right?
I've always been a high-low guy, and Bravo's always been a high-low guy.
But so when some people, though, in some of the circles where half the time you're spending your time, are saying to you, you know, giving you flack for bringing Housewives into the world, for instance. Yeah. People got increasingly, especially now that we have a reality president, you know, some people say, are you responsible for dumbing down America or whatever? You know, what's your answer to that?
I'm responsible for entertaining some people in America. Right. There are a million channels.
Right.
And, you know, Donald Trump is a jackass, but he is someone who knows how to speak in front of a television camera, and people relate to that. And he's someone who will say anything, and he entertained people, and he captivated the media, and he did every interview that he would do. And while Hillary Clinton wasn't doing any interviews, and so he did something. He captured a movement.
And
you know?
To your point, I want to quote back to you and then ask for your reaction. This is something that was in the New York Times just recently. Quote, Trump was not like one of Cohen's housewives. He knew he had to be entertaining to stay on the show. He was willing to say anything to get his contract extended. Throughout his campaign, he pulled the "I know something, but I'm not going to say it now."
This is all what I've said. This is all what I told a reporter from the Times.
But I mean, I want to expand on this. Most recently employed but I'm not going to say it now. Trick. Most recently employed by Bethany Frankel about dirt she has but won't reveal about both Dorinda and
he's
Jules.
He's a housewife. Yes.
And just because this is a testament to you, I think, in some way, at the debates, the candidates fought for time to speak and demanded that they be allowed the time they were promised, which is what happens at the reunions. And it goes on to say, quote, Anderson Cooper was a moderator of a debate in St. Louis that ended with the candidates saying something nice about each other, which is exactly how Cohen ends some Real Housewives reunions, close quote. Would there be a President Donald Trump without reality TV generally without you specifically?
Well, no. There would not be a Donald Trump, I don't think, without reality TV, but I will not please do not hang Donald Trump on me. I don't accept that.
Okay.
But he does act like a season one Orange County housewife.
Right.
Yes. I've been saying it for years.
Okay. So the last of these things were just how you respond to the flack, and then we move on to more. But what about from a feminism perspective? Are these shows good for women? And the reason, let me just tee it up here. We had Gloria Steinem on this podcast.
Yes, she hates the housewives. And I know was, she says that
we didn't even ask her about it. We said, talk to us about the Kardashians. Yes. And this was her answer. Quote, it isn't the individuals who are at fault. It's the culture that says you are rewarded for your outsides, not your insides. But I regret it and it's painful. It's not quite as painful as The Housewives, which is perhaps the most painful. That's the closest to a female minstrel show that I can imagine. But again, I understand why. Those women are looking for a way to start their businesses or get to be known. So it's not to criticize the people who are in the game. It's to change the game. It's embarrassing, close quote. Is that unfair?
I think it's fine that she feels that way. Right. And I think if it was the only representation of women on television, I think that this would be a real, real serious conversation. Right. It isn't. There are many, many portrayals of women on television. And I know that Gloria Steinem has not watched a full season of any Housewives, right, where there are moments of incredible greatness and triumph and strength and beauty for the female race. It wouldn't still be working. Listen, if it was just a ratchet buffoonery, it would not still be going as strong as it is. It just wouldn't. There are, you know, moments of beauty and strength in these shows. There just are. And there are millions of smart, strong feminists who watch and love The Real Housewives and somehow identify with the women. Listen, there are some bad role models on the show. And there are also some good ones. Mm-hmm. If it was only bad, it couldn't sustain itself.
Yeah. So in the midst of it becoming this phenomenon, which regardless of how anyone feels, it certainly is, you know, we've said it's July 2009. You go on now for the first time with Watch What Happens Live as this basically an after show for initially, yes, Top Shelf, then Real Housewives. Talk about how small a thing this started out as, because you mentioned there's not even a fan.
I mean, it's still, yeah, there was no fan. I mean, we were in this small room and
22 seats.
Yeah, 22 seats. It started as a Housewives after show. And the great thing about it was what it started as is still exactly what it is today. We're still the only live show in late night.
Why is that an asset?
Because in this universe of everything changing every half hour,
right,
it's a real asset for us, especially in pop culture. It allows us to be on top of pop culture and news. It also, you know, and timely in a way that other people aren't. I mean, even if you look at the late night shows that are about politics, they tape at 5.
Right.
I mean, it's 6 hours later, they're getting on the air. I mean, 6 hours at this moment. Now, I don't do a lot of politics, but I certainly can be super reactive, mm-hmm, when pop culture news breaks and when news breaks. Also, the live thing is, I feel like I'm surprised. In my mind, we've created an entirely new genre in late night television, which can only be compared to what Howard Stern has done for years on morning television, on morning radio.
He's a big model for you, right?
He's a big model for me. I go there in a way that no other late night host does. And I did it at the beginning, and we start talking about the show as an after show for Housewives. And that's important because the Housewives are my whack pack. They are, and Howard has his whack pack,
right.
And they are my testing ground. And they're the people who I could originally drink with. And they're the people that I could ask anything.
And you could always book.
Always book. Except, you know, the brilliant thing that I did from the beginning is I got Real Housewives fans from the beginning because I knew that the show was not going to sustain itself.
Right.
And I didn't want it to be a show that only Housewives was on. So in that first initial batch, I was calling on people that I knew and friends to come on the show. I had Sarah Jessica Parker. I had Tina Fey. I had, mm-hmm, Liam Neeson, Jerry, mm-hmm, Seinfeld. Now, Liam and Jerry didn't talk about the Housewives.
Right.
So that's when I was proving to Bravo, this show can be more than a show about the Housewives. That's what I was doing. And that's what it became.
Sure.
And I think they early on very smartly saw, well, wait a minute. Now we have someone besides Jim Lipton who's getting huge stars to come on Bravo, but they're playing games and they're drinking and they're making news.
And bringing down your audience age quite a bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were... What's so important to me about how the Housewives have impacted me on Watch What Happens Live and how Howard Stern has is the notion of me going there. And I know Bravo has a big ad campaign saying he goes there right now. Mm-hmm. But it's true because this is the only show in late night television where you're going to see a host going there in the way of trying to generate news and ask questions and be dangerous. I want this show to feel dangerous and unscripted and sometimes awkward and always exciting. We don't pre-interview our guests. It is not canned. They don't come and say, Andy loved the story when you whatever.
Right.
We let the conversation go and it always pays off.
And to your point about sort of what sets it apart from other shows, you know, Corden might quibble, but you're the only guys that have a real open bar, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
he
that was it.
It's there in the background, but he doesn't use it. You guys use it.
Yeah, I know. He said at the beginning, he was like, "We're the only late night show that has a bar."
Yeah.
I'm like,
"You gotta
sweetie,
use it."
I've been on the show for on the air for like 8 years already.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And then I don't know if CBS would actually let them drink on
yeah,
the show.
Yeah, no, we absolutely drink.
So there's that. Also, from the beginning, interactivity with the audience.
Well, that's the other thing. We knew that if we were going to be live, we were going to be interactive. And so this is that's the other reason why live is so important to us. The audience, they generate the conversation. So we've got a million polls going every episode. People are calling. I've got people on Twitter calling bullshit to what people are saying on the show and saying, you know, as simple as like, I love your shoes. Who made those? I mean, those little things where the audience can get in there. It helps me dictate what people want to know.
If you were to sort of step outside of this for a second and try to dissect the audience member, let's say your average viewer, it may have started, maybe the initial lure was the Housewives, but what is the underlying reason why they are into this guy who they probably didn't really, maybe they'd heard of as a guy behind the Housewives, but, you know, is it, because you're very open about your own life, the set, it creates a very intimate feel that seems like it's your place.
Yeah.
But is it aspirational that they see what your life is like and they want to?
I think it's because I'm their friend. And I think people view me as their friend.
Yeah.
And people come up to me every day. And TV is very intimate. And I share on social media and I share on the show.
Right.
But to me, this show is about me and the people watching. And we're doing it. We're in it together. Because the viewers are a part of the conversation. So they're in on it. So I think when people come up to me and say, you don't realize it, but we're, you know, like you're my best friend or we're friends. I'm like, no, I do. Like, you know. And if I can be their buddy, then that is great to me. Then I've done my job. It's, you know, if I'm tucking people in at night, that's an intimate thing.
Oh yeah.
I say I'm a fluffer for straight guys because like I get their wives all hopped up and then they, you know, I'm gone in a half an hour and they've been playing the drinking game and it's like, hey honey. And I'm like, you're welcome, straight guys.
That's great.
But the other great thing is that there are more guys that come up to me and say, you know what? My wife got me into your show and I never miss it. And I don't even really watch the Housewives, but I love your show. You know, so the great thing is we have the Housewives a couple nights a week and then, you know, the other three were everything else. And I think I also think that speaks to the sensibility of what's going on in the culture. Reality stars are stars now, legitimate. You know, it's different. They're on the cover of Us magazine. So I think that's why Watch What Happens Live resonates in a way that others don't.
All that explains why viewers want to watch. What I wonder if you can explain is, why do you think you get away with the sort of questions with guests that they might not put up with from other people? Knowing that that's what they're signing up for, they still come.
I think they want a good time and they want something spontaneous. My show is an easy show to do. We don't do a pre-interview. Mm-hmm. I hate doing pre-interviews. You sit there trying to come up with funny stories that have happened to you for the last 6 weeks.
Right.
I'm situationally funny. I'm not a comedian.
Right.
So like, I don't have a routine to go in and do. And same with most of my guests. It's It's fun. I think people who are doing the talk show rounds, I think they like to challenge themselves. Right. And also, I think it's an aspirational place that people want to be. I think, you know, so many people are now coming and doing my show and they're like, I can't wait to do this. Oh my God, I can't wait to see what happens. They can't wait to see what happens. But the other thing is, I know that they know that I'm celebrating them. Mm-hmm. If I ask a really pointed plead the fifth question, listen, I'll take any answer. It's just the gift of the universe that people actually will reveal stuff. Engage, you know?
The show's popularity and yours obviously are largely intertwined. And so the show moved to two nights and then I guess in January 2012, five nights.
Yeah.
And obviously a larger space, 50 seats, I believe. And as the fan base...
We have 30 seats.
30
now.
Seats?
It was 22, and now we're like 33 30. Or something like that. We're in a new studio, which is upstairs from our old studio, and we have real green rooms now. We're not like breaking down our conference room to make green rooms.
So how, though, as the show's taking off, did your life change, and how did that greater familiarity with you impact the way that you go about doing the show? It must be a little different.
It's actually fairly, you know, there have been little tweaks that have, but the truth is it is as spontaneous and as organic a growth as it could ever be.
And but you don't feel like now, okay, so I'm in the club, I'm going to be a little bit more timid about how I ask something, or I'm going to be a little less crass or whatever it might be. It doesn't.
I'm going to be me because the thing is, the viewers will cry bullshit on me. You know, they are part of the conversation.
Right.
And so they want me, you know, it's what they expect. It's what the show is. And there's no other show like it. So
no. In late 2011, as the show was about to expand to the five nights a week, your day job began to change and has subsequently continued to change.
I left my day job.
Right.
Yes.
But that was when by the time 2013, right? Then it's all gone.
Yes. So I spent 1 year running. I took away my production job and then I was in charge of development with an incredible team. So for a year, I was doing the show five nights a week and running development at Bravo, which is a lot.
Yeah.
But if you consider that now I'm five nights a week and I'm still EP of all the Housewives, I'm doing reunion shows, I have my own radio channel on Sirius, I'm touring with Anderson, I'm writing books. Yeah. So I still have
a pretty full plate.
Yeah.
But does any part of you miss the stuff that you were doing before the show, or are you
not
happy
really because I'm developing and producing shows out of my production company. Right. I have a show called Andy Cohen Then and Now. I just went to Bravo with two other pitches for other shows not involving me. Mm-hmm. I'm hosting Love Connection on Fox. I'm a producer of everything I do, and I'm still the very active executive producer of Watch What Happens Live and The Housewives.
Right.
So that is where I can work my muscle.
May I take a page out of your book, and you referenced Plead the Fifth?
Yeah.
Can we do a round?
Yeah.
Okay. So just so people who aren't familiar with it, I mean, it's basically three questions. You can evade one by pleading the fifth.
Exactly.
So first of all, to begin with a game that you call politely Marry, Shag, Kill.
Yeah.
Howard's game, right.
Yeah.
Of your current late night competitors, you have to pick one for each.
Oh, of the current, okay, who would I marry, who would I shag, and who would I kill? I would marry, oh God, okay, I would marry Jimmy Fallon.
Mm-hmm.
I would shag, who would I shag? I would shag Kimmel. Who would I kill? See, when Chelsea was on at 11, I would have killed her because she was my competition. I guess I would kill Corden, because he has guests out at the same time.
Right.
His format is the most like mine.
And he's still going on about his bar. So that's
really.
Okay, number two. Were you ever approached about replacing Regis Philbin or later Michael Strahan?
No, I was not.
Never even
I
started.
Subbed with Kelly. There was never, there was never a real conversation. No.
Who is the celebrity guest who you came to dislike the most after actually interacting with them?
See, I could plead the fifth right now.
Yes.
I will say, you know, I had higher hopes for one of our great political minds, Scott Baio, who was on. And then I guess I was being I love Scott Baio. I'm a huge Scott Baio fan. But I think we played a game called Andy Loves Crotchy, like Joni Loves Crotchy,
yes,
where he had to guess like celebrity crotches of ex-girlfriends.
Oh, God.
And at Mrs. Scott Baio decided she hated the game and was like tweeting me all during the thing and then blocked me on Twitter. And then But I don't dislike him.
Right.
Because, again, he is one of our great political minds. And so maybe him.
All right. Just to try to get away with one other one.
Okay.
What's the drunkest you've ever been on your show?
You know what? In the early days, I used to get really hammered on the show because they would really... I was so excited about drinking on the air. It was such a novelty, and we were on at midnight, and I just felt like I was freaking Johnny Carson or something. I don't know who I thought I was.
Dean Martin.
I was just, Dean Martin. I just was really excited by it. Then that got a little old, but there was an episode with Kylie Minogue and Elijah Wood, and... Yeah, I saw Kylie Minogue like 6 months later at the Met Ball, and I said, oh my God, that was so fun. We were so drunk. And she goes, you were so drunk. And I was like, uh-oh, I can't do this.
You got to go back and watch that one. Yeah. I'll have to go back and watch.
Right.
But a final question, just big picture, is obviously a lot has happened in the last roughly a decade, right? So, yeah, I mean, what do you make of that now that, you know, we've sat here and kind of, I don't know how often you go through it all like this.
Yeah.
But, you know, A, what do you make of it? And B, what's on the bucket list though? I mean, you're obviously an ambitious, creative guy.
Right.
What's left to do?
What I make of it is that the great thing is that my passion for what I was doing at the time was always led to my happiness. And I feel like that was a circle, and not to get to Oprah, but I remember when I started at CBS News, just the fact that I was getting a check that said CBS on it. I thought I had made it then. And then I thought every job I've had, I thought I made it.
Yeah.
So I was never looking like, I never got too political. I never got too crazy. I'm not saying I was never ambitious, because I've always been ambitious, but I was always passionate and happy. And I think if you can be happy with the opportunities that you have and are given, that's going to make you better at your job. And it certainly made me better at my job. And you know, I took one or two big risks, which really paid off. But, you know, just the fact that you can't, I just let everything happen organically. And I'm so glad that I did. And in terms of my bucket list, you know, weirdly, Love Connection was kind of a big bucket list. It's a big network show. I've wanted to do a big network show. It's also a show that is perfectly suited for me. It has game elements, which I've always wanted to kind of host a game show. Mm-hmm. And so I just think the combination of the six or eight things that I'm doing right now, I don't really have anything left on my bucket list.
Right.
I wouldn't want to do a network late night show at this point. No one that I know watches TV at 12:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. So like there was a moment in time where there were openings at 12:30. And I was like, the truth of the matter is I don't even watch TV at 12:30 and I'm up at 12:30.
Right.
So like, I just feel like so many people come up to me and say, oh my God, I stay up late to watch your show. My show's on at 11.
Mm-hmm.
People have jobs. A lot of people watch my show in the morning. They DVR and watch it in the morning. So I love my time slot. And I love that I'm live.
Yeah.
I really, and Bravo has been such an incredible home for me, and they've allowed me to do so much, and they've allowed Watch What Happens Live to really grow into something super unique that I'm very proud of.
Without the kinds of checks and balances that you probably would have to deal with at a network.
Absolutely. Frances Barrick has not given me a note. She has encouraged me to be myself. And the one note that she gave me was to shave my beard once, because she didn't like my
beard.
She
didn't like it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. Yeah. Appreciate it.